Hello, everybody, and welcome to the inaugural episode of Pixels and Profit, where we talk about game industry news with a focus on the business of games. Our focus for today, where are we in terms of the free-to-play games industry? And then two, we'll discuss outlook of major game publishers and discuss highlights from earnings, maybe some key trends and themes. I think we're also going to talk a little bit about Embracer and kind of some of the big news around that company. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Joseph Kim, CEO of mobile free-to-play FPS shooter game company, Leela Games, and a longtime content creator for Game Makers. We also have two other co-hosts for this segment, Matthew Conterman and Brian Peganoff. And just for our audience, guys, maybe you guys could do a quick intro so people know a little bit more about your backgrounds and who you guys are.
Let me go first.
Go for it.
All right. I'm Brian, founder and employee one at Timber Advisors, a consultancy and advisory business I started about 2 years ago. I do strategy, corporate development, and funding work for video game development studios and games adjacent software businesses. And I also spend some time with investors on public equities focused on the gaming industry and broader tech and media. Thanks, Joe.
Hey, I'm Matthew. I'm the director of research at Roundhill Investments. We're a registered investment advisor. We issue ETFs and we have about a dozen ETFs right now, plus or minus. We have roughly $650 million of assets today. I'm also the portfolio manager on the Roundhill Generative AI and Technology ETF, ticker CHAT.
Awesome. All right, so let's kick this off with what I consider to be a very fundamental question. Now, the mobile games industry and the games industry in general is very dynamic. Free-to-play is super dynamic. And so the question is, like, where are we today? And I recently wrote a newsletter post about the macro shift in terms of like having a zero interest rate environment and living in an age of excess to now moving to the age of efficiency. And in fact, when you look at company like Meta and some of the things that Mark Zuckerberg has talked about, you know, this is 2023 is the year that Mark Zuckerberg is calling the year of efficiency. And I think when we look at the entire tech sector, it's been hit by massive layoffs, and we feel that in the games industry as well. And I see it even in India, you know, an economy that has otherwise been booming, and just anecdotally, hiring has become tremendously easier. And I think more globally, anecdotally, I've been hearing a major shift from major game studios around the world away from like new game development initiatives to focusing on live ops, on things that are more profitable, more proven. And we've seen a fair amount of M&A picking back up as companies struggle to grow in this current environment. Now, whether that's because of IDFA or other issues, we can talk about. But and that's something that we'll probably discuss later in our conversation today. But I thought I could start with opening with this fundamental question, thoughts in terms of macro trends and themes. What do you guys think? So with this question, this broad question, where are we? What do you guys think? Well, maybe starting with you, Matthew, what do you think?
We're just in this weird, bizarro world that we've been in for like probably the better part of a decade at this point. But, you know, I think for the last 6 to 12 months, you know, I consider myself fairly cynical. And, you know, particularly for public companies, CEOs understand what the market rewards them and understand what drives their stock prices. Over the last 12 months, improving your margins and cutting costs has driven stock prices. And so, you know, cynically, you know, you've seen a lot of public companies, not just Meta, Zuckerberg do it, but now pretty much everyone is cutting costs. And when they announce cost cuts, their stock goes up. And as long as that's the case, that's going to be the focus for these companies. And when you take that to a global macro perspective, right, we have uncertainty around inflation, uncertainty around GDP growth, uncertainty around interest rates, uncertainty around geopolitics and in this, you know, tech cold war that's still going on between the US and China. And so when you put all that together, you can understand why companies and executives want to, you know, not be taking too many long-term risky bets in this environment. They want to understand what they have and get the most out of it. We're going to talk about generative AI later and how that ties in as well. But that's also part of the discussion around efficiency and taking advantage of new technology and getting the most out of the resources you have rather than investing more in new resources.
Yeah, I think adding to that, cost of capital has had huge impacts on the entire economy, and gaming is, you know, certainly not immune. I think it largely makes sense for publishers and developers to focus on the MAU and DAU they have or revitalize IP that's been on the shelf. that does bring a much higher success rate or hit rate versus starting from scratch and developing new IP. And you just don't want to green light 3 to 5 years of work in an uncertain backdrop like this. And gaming publishers, particularly in mobile, have had to make a lot of tough decisions on the quantum of capital they put to work in UA. And adding to that, the IDFA changes have made attribution like way less clear. So there's been a lot of results, and I guess I'll just bullet point a few of them. Generally speaking, shrinking DAU and MAU metrics, in some cases offset by stuffing in lower tier geos. The highest performers have been able to offset revenue headwinds with expertise in live ops and monetization, and like King and SciPlay are some good examples of those, and also benefits of scale. And then games that have flashed strong growth in prior years, but were driven by like longer payback windows, have suffered the most. And this isn't a great backdrop for bringing new players into games with complex fatuis and super deep metagames. And many of those companies were, as Joe mentioned earlier, acquired during the pandemic boom. So companies that have managed to raise substantial equity rounds during the pandemic are a little bit more insulated, and they continue to spend into those longer windows. But the other kind of like cautionary tale there is that the ECM and IPO businesses have not resumed to normal. And it's unlikely to until like probably mid to late next year, best case. So those companies do need to be diligent and burn. They can't do this in perpetuity. And, you know, if we had to like launch those into equity markets now, I think a lot of investors would thumb their nose at the valuations that those were done at prior. So, you know, whatever your number is for mobile growth or contraction for 23-24, it doesn't really matter a ton. That's only like 20% of the battle. And there's always these massive shifts that occur within certain genres and games and things like that. And I guess if I could just end with one silver lining to less competitive UA, which is driven by cost of capital, it's like potentially better launch dynamics for highly performant games. And, you know, a company like Scopely and Monopoly Go is probably a good recent example of this. But it's also one other thing that I think Joe might be able to be a little bit more apt to speak on is just this notion that gaming is recession-proof. And I think we're starting to see some signs of that with mobile at least not puking anymore. But I do think that will be tested in a prolonged higher rates backdrop.
Right. And maybe I could speak on that a little bit. So I do think like just my own perspective in terms of gaming being recession-proof is that, especially when we think of premium game products, I do think that's recession-proof just because the value for your entertainment dollar is so low. But I think the nuance there is like when we think about IAP spend, especially for like whale-driven games or games with like higher ARPU, lower conversion, higher ARPU-poo, those are the types of games where I think we need to consider IAP spend for those games a little bit more discretionary versus non-discretionary. So those will actually be impacted by a recession and things like that.
I just wanted to tack on and to your point, you know, and this is something that we've been making a point of in some of our research is, you know, the economy is bifurcating between the haves and have-nots, and you've seen it in gaming, right? You've seen, for example, Call of Duty, you know, came out last year and took the wind out of a lot of other games. It took the wind out of Apex. It took the wind out of other titles. What's clear is that the leaders and the best titles are taking away market share, and they're taking time spent. They're taking the dollars. And so, you know, from that perspective, you're seeing that in the gaming industry, but you're seeing it pretty much everywhere in the economy. And that's this weird bifurcation that's going on. And I think that's part of the reason that people are still trying to figure out if we're going to have a global recession, a domestic recession or not, is because on the micro level, you look at one company and they're struggling, you look at another, they're doing very well. And it's really hard to kind of parse out the signal to the noise right now.
So my own take on where we are today is that I think the short to medium term theme is basically around efficiency. And especially if there's a recession, I think we really have to think about this trend that may play out over the next, call it 5 to 10 years, where we potentially also, not only because of efficiency, I think that kind of turbocharges this trend, but I think we've had some structural changes when we look at global competitiveness because the world is becoming increasingly global. I think education is shifting towards other parts of the globe and other geos where you know it's been more difficult for them to kind of catch up in terms of skill and capability. But I do think there may be a changing of the guard as old incumbents and even what are considered powerhouses like, you know, like Blizzard or Rockstar may start to lose their power as insurgents, especially from the East, particularly China. We've got companies like Hoyoverse with Genshin Impact and Honkai Star Rail that are both top 10 revenue games worldwide. We've got Lilith, Game Science, maybe even Fun Plus, and others that are beginning to rise and dominate. And they dominate with efficiency, with a killer work ethic, 996, or yeah, it's 996, cost structure advantage, and the deployment of capital to a scale that a lot of people in the West can't compete with. Like Hoyoverse is reportedly spending like $200 million a year on Genshin. So in that kind of scenario, who can compete against that? With what team, with what work ethic, with what cost structure? And so to some degree, against these longer term trends, you know, resistance is futile. So I think today, when we think about the West, I mean, the West still is powerful. It's got advantage in terms of current talent, skill, IP, art, the ability to be more innovative than other places. But I do think that China and others globally can catch up over time. And to not think so is a little bit naive. So I do think we continue to see disruption in the West. I think that continues to play out over the next 5 to 10 years, unless things change. But assuming we continue along the same path that we have been going to, I do think that it's a different environment. We're not in a ZERP environment anymore, in an age of excess that we've been living in over the last 10, 20, 20 plus years. And so I think unless something changes, it continues as it has before.
Yeah. I mean, just to your point, you know, if you look at some of the Chinese, the large Chinese internet companies, Tencent, NetEase, they're the largest gaming companies in the world for those that, you know, don't actually track their revenues. But, you know, Tencent wants to get 50% of its gaming revenue outside of China, you know, in the next several years. They're at roughly 25% today. Obviously, that includes Riot, that includes Supercell. So some of that will come from new games from those studios. But, you know, some of that also comes from their domestic studios, which they've also opened, you know, their own satellite branches in the West. But they want to make games based on their IPs for the West, for console in particular, for PC, you know, where they don't have as big of an exposure outside of China. We know of them for their mobile expertise, but if they can really replicate their live services expertise on console, I think that's going to be a big awakening for a lot of Western companies, because for up until now, the risk has been these guys in China are great at mobile. They're great at mobile live ops. They make the best mobile RPGs that are shooters. That's why everyone's partnered with them, but they're not going to do it on HD. They're not going to do it on console in particular. And if they're successful there, that's going to be a big wake-up call to a lot of people.
Right.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And just particularly for older gaming cohorts like me and probably you guys too, we have this kind of love affair with time-tested IP, and it's really hard to disrupt the older folks, but it's also really easy to disrupt the younger generations. And we've seen that with American and non-American innovation with things like Fortnite and Roblox. And I guess the other point to say is like IP doesn't stay on the shelf forever. It's not like, I guess it's kind of like kimchi, right? It'll stay in the fridge for a few weeks, but if you leave it in there for a few months, so just multiply that by 12, you know, companies like Embracer or Ubisoft, like you can't just count on those games printing units for the rest of your foreseeable future. You have to keep that innovation quotient strong. And if you lose focus on that, that's an easy way to dig your own grave in gaming.
Right. So, you know, the title of our podcast is Pixels and Profits. And as we, you know, you guys are two finance guys, but as we maybe kind of shift focus maybe to earnings companies and maybe even starting with a discussion around where we are with respect to M&A. And just my own perspective on this is that, you know, we're kind of coming off this big run of, call it 5 to 10 years, led by companies like Zynga, Embracer, Stillfront, MTG, companies like that. And at least the way that I've interpreted the last, you know, 5, 10 years is that what happened and what Zynga kind of really pushed was like doing a lot of these pickups that hit mid-scale companies. And it really started by picking these guys off with like the easy pickups, meaning more Lego type of, you know, kind of plug and play types of companies that you could just kind of plug into your company. And, but they got increasingly harder as more and more companies got picked off. And Zynga was obviously a clear winner during this environment. They got some of the easiest companies to kind of acquire. They kind of led the charge there. But what that led to, in my opinion, was that a lot of mid-tier scale companies kind of got hollowed out, at least the easy ones. And so then what happened when a lot of the mid-tier scale companies got acquired was that left more room on kind of like upstream, downstream. So then you'd have to shift to smaller companies or much bigger companies. And in terms of the upstream, you know, we had a lot of seed funded companies, but then as, you know, market dynamics changed, the investing market got a little bit tougher. I think a lot of startups missed their Series A's. And so, you know, we had a lot of companies that got acquired on the cheap as acqui-hires. And so that's kind of going upstream, and then downstream, just moving to bigger scale pickups, like the big boy pickups, the Scopely's, Rovio's, you know, Activision. We'll see what happens there. And that's sort of where we are now. But I think, though, kind of my perspective on this, and feel free to push back on me if you guys think I'm wrong, is that the ocean at this point in terms of fish is kind of, you know, it's not empty, but it's rather sparse. And so maybe there's a little bit of a timeout necessary where, you know, M&A activity needs a little bit more time for fish kind of like upstream to get bigger and to populate the ocean. And then it'll be likely where more deals will happen, but we need some of these companies to kind of get bigger scale so that they can kind of, we can see more M&A activity, especially in the mid-tier scale. And, you know, when I, you know, just kind of going through some of the financial reporting, I saw that, you know, looking at a company like EA, relatively quiet on the M&A front for the last six quarters. So, you know, after they kind of jumped in with deals like Glue and Playdemic, you know, it's been relatively quiet. So I do feel like we are kind of like in this different environment now. And, you know, it's just a different time.
Yeah, I just wanted to jump in. You mentioned Zynga. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, they kind of, I'm not going to say they were the first because M&As always happen, but they were kind of the poster child for, right, you know, buying these, let's call them $100 to $500 million deals. That was kind of the sweet spot for Zynga once they figured out their M&A strategy. By the way, you had an excellent podcast with Chris Petrovich, like mm-hmm. probably 2 years ago now, which is still, if you haven't listened to that about integrating acquisitions and gaming, you got to go listen to that because that's like the textbook for doing it basically. But they had a system in place that they had built over time and they had failed before they figured it out with a couple acquisitions. So it's not like you can just buy something and it works. They had a plan, they had a structure in place that made that M&A roll-up strategy work. And they knew what they were going for. They were going for companies that were on the verge of basically launching games. And effectively they were buying them right at the time as they were scaling and going into UA. And so they knew what they were doing and they knew exactly what they were looking for. But that middle kind of tier companies, to your point, got thinned out and something left. And that's when Zynga kind of got to the point, they kind of got helped by COVID and they bought Rollic, but you know, they got to the point where there was no growth left. There was no companies left to buy in that tier. And their organic growth was never really good. They weren't great at actually launching games organically for several years before that. It was all inorganic. And, you know, and so they tried by being an ad network and that didn't work. And they got bailed out by Take-Two. You know, that was good yes. for them. So, you know, it's you know, but they were in a tough spot. And you're seeing other companies that were these inorganic growth stories, M&A roll-up stories, cost of capital went up. Their equity currency went down because the stock market went down, which is also a big factor in these deals when you don't have the equity kicker that's as valuable anymore. And you know, just, and then you just had the market kind of slow down as well, like the gaming market, all that together just put this on pause. Now, hopefully, to your point, some of these cohort of companies that raised money in 21 and early 22, in a year, maybe two, they'll be at that precipice of kind of that sweet spot where it makes sense for M&A again. And we're already starting to see it pick up a little bit, but you know, it doesn't seem like what's happening so far is sustainable. I do think that we're still a few quarters away from a big pickup in capital markets in the gaming sector.
Yeah, I think interesting point, just to dovetail on what you guys just said, particularly around Zynga and them kind of formalizing the strategy behind the mobile gaming rollup. The competition got so fierce that buying and leaving alone became kind of the new rage, and it became contractual, right? It's built into earnout structures and things like that. So you had these large companies, and this is mainly something that was like Stillfront and Embracer. They could no longer compete on price. They could meet on price, but they could say, hey, you can come over here and run your own fiefdom, 3 years of earnouts and like, you know, go have at it. And then really they started to build the functions around supporting those studios through things like UA and marketing and live ops far too late, right? And at that point, it's like the battle's almost over. How are you going to control studios that are contractually unobligated to listen to you? So I guess just on the broader themes, from an M&A perspective, I think we're going to see more big ticket M&A before resumption of this 500 million and kind of below kind of tickets. And the latter of which over the last 3 years was mainly confined to mobile, largely financial engineering trades, and in most cases, unsuccessful for the reasons you guys so eloquently pointed out. And this very much goes back to the current cost of capital again. It's like a broken record. And plus, you know, depressed share prices. These deals are just far too expensive against that backdrop, and neither management teams nor shareholders are going to get paid for those with share prices like in prior years. So, and again, with ECM and secondary biz and the tanker, it's just pain across financial services industries, and publishers are going to struggle to raise capital now versus prior years, regardless of being public or not. As you guys mentioned, we're starting to see larger strategic deal flow, which we can pick apart on merit and valuations. But, you know, with strategic deal flow, there's less urgency to overanalyze cash returns because the transactions are kind of like materially reshaping the structure of the acquirer, not just the income statement and fundamentals. So again, I think we'll kind of return to that lower tickets in mobile again, maybe 3 to 6 months from now. But my sense is that management teams are waiting out the economic headwinds and hoping for multiple compression. And as usual, I think they'll probably wait a little bit too long, but you know, that's neither here nor there.
And I just, I pulled some numbers, I put some numbers behind kind of where we're at versus where we were in M&A in the sector. And, you know, hopefully this helps kind of tie everything together. So, so far in the second quarter of 2023, 6 billion of deals announced. It was 1.2 billion a year ago. So the second quarter of last year is when it kind of fell out, when that's when the floor fell out. First quarter of 2022 was the peak, $85.5 billion of deals announced. Even if you take out Activision from that, it was still $16.5 billion because that was Zynga and a few others. So it was still large. And if you just step away from the dollars and look at the number of deals being done, we've only had about 20 deals done this quarter versus 60 a year ago. So it's both value and volume are down a lot. And so when we look at it, both value and volume of deals in the sector are down year on year. And so that's telling us that it's still kind of quiet. People aren't dipping their toes in. I agree with Brian. It'll still be a couple quarters before we really see it. And the most exciting companies were fortunate that they were able to raise funds, you know, a year or 2 years ago at elevated valuations. So A, they are funded. They don't need money right now necessarily. And B, their investors and their insight, the employees are anchored at a much higher valuation than what's available in the market. They're not going to take a down round because they don't have to. And so that's also part of the reason that there's this impasse.
Got it. Should we talk about specific names or like recent transactions? Do you guys want to have any opinions on some of these recent transactions that have happened?
Absolutely. Want to start with the Rovio?
Yeah. What do you guys think?
I think this Sega makes a ton of sense strategically for Sega. I mean, I'm a Roblox stan, all right? I've been bullish on Roblox basically since it went public. It was good and it was not good for me for a while. You can go read a lot of our thesis on the metaverse on our website. But, you know, if you look at what's the number one most actively played third-party IP on Roblox, it's Sonic. It's the Sonic game from GameFam. There is so much easy pickings for Sega to do its magic again with its third-party partners on Roblox with the Rovio IP, with Angry Birds, alongside them just being better at mobile, right, which they aren't at. So they get all the strategic know-how for mobile growth, mobile UA from Rovio, and I think there's this huge opportunity for Angry Birds on Roblox, which is completely untapped.
Yeah, I think Sega Sammy is an interesting little company. I mean, they're not just a video game company. They have this big business in arcades and pachinko and slots. It's also their free-to-play business is super heavy Japan. It's like 88%. Overseas is the remaining 12%, and it's very condensed in this mid-hardcore range. And mobile is only 38% of total revenue. So Rovio materially increases the mobile share outside of Japan and pushes that almost to 50-50. Rovio, for all its challenges, has actually been pretty relatively stable as of late. They never really did the grip it and rip it UA model. It's 2.5 times revenue is about, and low teens, mid-teens, EBITDA multiple. there's also this strong alignment on IP and licensing businesses that goes to feature films and games and studio and theme parks. And it also gives Sega a really strong access to a really good development market in Helsinki and decent publisher functions outside of just Japan. And that casual experience that they're missing. Like Sonic is a 30-year-old iconic IP and it's making some traction on Roblox, but it's really nowhere on mobile platforms. And they're not the only Asian publisher that has a challenge with that, right? Like Nintendo is very similar. And I guess most importantly, in my opinion, is that it provides a ton of insulation to public markets, which is really tough on Rovio employees. And I would argue that it's been, you know, it's just not very well built to be a public company. It's just too small. It's not their fault. It's just like, scale matters in that business.
I would just add briefly, you know, when you just think about this transaction, I believe that Playtika offered more money per share than Sega did for Rovio. I got to go back and check what the last offer was. It was either competitive or it was slightly more. I also think that's a whole other discussion that we don't have to have today, but you know, Playtika did a lot of acquisitions in the Nordics. They built a reputation for being very aggressive on cost cuts and laying off a lot of people.
I can tell you exactly why.
No, because it happened, because they absolutely did it. And so, you know, I'm trying to be politically correct to some degree. I don't want to piss off too many people today. But, you know, it's clear that that was an issue in these discussions because they got rejected 3 times by Rovio. And then Sega comes in with a competitive or slightly underbid and they found a deal together.
Yeah. So as a former Sega exec, I can tell you that I do think like Sega is very friendly, especially they're very management friendly as opposed to, you know, what we've heard at least from Playtika. And so clearly I think where Rovio is coming from is that they want to work with somebody that's more hands off and they want to operate as they've been operating. Now, I think that you guys brought up a lot of great points. I'm a little bit more neutral and not as positive on the acquisition. I think the strategy that you guys are talking about absolutely makes sense. I think everything that you guys have raised makes sense. The thing that I am more concerned about is that, are we living in an age of efficiency? Rovio is not efficient. And so I think that this is where if we are actually moving into this new era of efficiency, I think this is where killers matter, right? If you are a killer, you're gonna do well. I don't see Rovio as a killer, right? And so I think that's where I do think Rovio is a little bit, you know, it's, you know, kind of Finnish European culture. They're, you know, good in an age of excess. I'm a little bit more concerned. And by the way, I'm a huge Sega and Rovio fan, just to be clear, but I'm concerned it may be a little too soft right now for today's environment.
I totally get your point. You know, we're talking about operating efficiently and knowing what you have and taking the most of it. And I don't think, well, Rovio employees won't say it, but I think everyone externally, whether you're a financial analyst or you're a strategic person, you look at Rovio and you say there's too much bloat. There's lots of subscale franchises that probably need to be, you know, put away and shrink those teams down, put them into things that are generating, you know, EBITDA. And it may not have. I mean, I think the reason the Sega deal got done is because they promised, whether it was, you know, a handshake agreement or it's in print, that they promised not to do that.
Yeah,
I guess like the bloat thing is certainly something to be focused on. And there is ample room for execution misses, but at least on the numbers, Rovio is actually more profitable than Sega Sammy. So it's a pretty good fit from a fundamentals perspective. Mm-hmm. But yeah, something you got to keep an eye on. Is Rovio had a good track record over the last 3 or 4 years of launching big hits? Like, absolutely not. But, you know, is there a good organic flow for Sonic on mobile? Maybe. And that's probably the most important thing that folks need right now in mobile is good organic flow.
Right. You guys have thoughts on Scopely Savvy?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think like this one's pretty useless to validate on fundamentals. Scopely, you know, plus or minus $1 billion in bookings and bought for $5 billion in cash, $4.9 billion in cash. So there's really no payback period that matters in this scheme. But Savvy made a big splash with ambitions to put $40 billion to work in gaming. Historically, they've been just buying up non-controlling stakes in big public companies like Activision and EA with zero operational input and passive. And what they bought was pretty good mobile diversification, instant scale, one of the more capable mobile publishers in the business with ambitions also in PC and console, proven management team that excels in corporate business development and licensing. And, you know, I would kind of expect, going back to the prior discussion on M&A, Scopely to kind of lead the way on mobile going forward. They're not going to wait around the hoop for valuations to overcompress like some pure public plays. And they have just kind of like this unlimited checkbook now. So it's fun to watch for sure.
I think to Brian's point, you know, we're going to sit here and talk about the EBITDA synergies and accretion, but none of that is relevant for Savvy Games Group. Their mission is to make Saudi Arabia a hub for game development in the Middle East and to get people to move there. They don't care how much money they burn doing it. And so, you know, when you think about it that way, this deal makes a lot of sense. You're buying a very established publisher who knows what they're doing. And then if you can go out and attract, you know, small development teams to move to Saudi Arabia and the new city they're building in the desert, I think it's called Neom, if I'm correct, right? If they can start attract, and UAE is doing the same thing with Crypto Bros, you know, if they can attract the talent, the economy will benefit because there's more talent and more money flowing in through those businesses. And then they have the Western business acting as the publisher until they build that up domestically. That's what this is about. And from that perspective, it makes a lot of sense if you don't care about losing money and about the valuation you're paying for it.
Yeah, I don't have anything to add besides, yeah, I think outside of strategic reasons, I don't think it makes any sense.
But also, okay, if you think about it, like there was no one else that they could, that fits the bill that Scopely fits, right? They want someone who's a mobile publisher, and anyone else that basically checked those boxes was already acquired, right? Zynga, Glue, a few others are basically already gone. And so there wasn't much left other than Scopely from a large established mobile publishing organization in the West at this point that was independent.
And if you're Scopely's management team and you're looking at the ECM calendar and things like that, you have a decent path to get to the public markets. I think, you know, not super profitable, but profitable enough. They had the scale. The growth trends would kind of normalize post-pandemic boom over the next, you know, 6 months, call it or whatever. And they could make it work institutional. But then you have like $5 billion in your face. Like, you're not going to get that in your market, you know, even a year from now if you grow 20%. So you might as well just hit that bid.
And remember, it's $5 billion today plus whatever amount they're going to give you to invest and grow the business on top of that, right? It's not just the upfront check. It's you know, the checkbook is open.
And as we'll talk about with Embracer later, public markets are a kind of a shit show to operate into. It's like it's the devil you know, I guess, the devil you know.
All right. Any thoughts on Activision, guys? Which way is this going?
Matt, you want to start?
I think on Activision, precedent is against them, right? Because it's very difficult historically to overturn the CMA's decision. It's going to take a lot of work, because the UK courts just haven't ruled against the CMA in any large fashion percentage-wise. And so the numbers are against them. I personally think the ruling is stupid. I don't think that cloud gaming is relevant to the conversation. Mm-hmm. And if they're saying that it's not an impact on the console market and it's not going to affect the competitiveness there, like, that's enough for me. I don't see how, I personally don't see a world where cloud gaming is a standalone market. I see it as an enabling technology for what we already have. It's just going to be part of HD. And you already see that today, right? I can literally pick up my phone and play my Xbox games from my phone. Sony just announced a handheld where you can play your PS5 games on a handheld. Steam has the Steam Deck, right? You know, these kind of cloud gaming, cloud streaming devices are just ancillary to what we already have. And so I think from that, that's the argument they're going to make, at least, is that this is not a distinct market. This is the same market, just different access. And that's how they're going to try to sell it and get it overturned. But I do think it's going to be tough.
I wanted Matt to start because he's so sharp on regulatory. I am a big fan of Phil Spencer. I'm on record as saying that multiple times. And, you know, I want to believe this narrative that Microsoft is the place for developing games over long horizons and kind of the greater good in the industry. That being said, Redfall was a little bit of a disappointment for me. I don't think Sony would do that. They're going to take some punches on that for sure. And we also have to take into context, like, where Activision was when this deal was first consummated, right? Like, the shares were multi-year low. There was some more, like, stuff that we don't really necessarily need to dive into on like just HR and optics kind of things. And it made a ton of sense. There was a gap to fill in revenues. And, you know, coming out of that, Activision is kind of performing at like this breakneck speed. Like Activision is now relevant on mobile with Call of Duty. King is performing extraordinarily well. They have a really good pipeline. Blizzard may or may not get its mojo back. We have Diablo 4 coming not too far away. But at a high level, the cloud gaming stuff aside, I don't want to see the games business devolve into Netflix, right? And what I mean by that is I don't want to see this huge loss of economics to developers in a world where game success is driven solely on time spent. And I think AI has a part in this too. And the other thing I note is like Activision is now trying to hire for like corporate development and other central functions. And that's not something you typically do when you're about to be engulfed into a bigger organization. So I think it's kind of a toss up. And that hang up that we mentioned about this thumbs down from the UK on the fears around game stream business. I don't really see that being like a potential cure that Microsoft doesn't really care about. It's like, UK is also just a relatively small gaming market versus North America and the broader Europe. So I don't really see that as a needle mover. And I guess to just wrap with, I'm not like of the view that if Activision goes away, the bid for other large mega caps goes up materially. And that big tech kind of makes this huge land grab towards needing to buy content. I don't believe that $20 billion plus companies need an end game liquidity strategy. And I believe it is healthier for the gaming ecosystem, for IP partners, for employees, and for investors. And I do hope we see more sustainable companies emerge from the coming years in the public market. So I don't really have, it's kind of a coin flip because, you know, that's $70 billion too that Microsoft can have back. There's other things out there to be done with that kind of money. And I do think Activision, like I said, they can be supportive in a public environment because the fundamentals are just scorching hot right now.
Yeah, I think the discussion of what's good for the industry versus like what's good for the stock price are two different things, right? Because I think that, you know, Activision's not going to get the price they got in the deal if the deal breaks, right? The deal, you know, I think everyone's pending somewhere in the 60s plus or minus for the stock price when the deal breaks. So, you know, that's below, you know, the deal price for sure. I think $95 a share. Right. So, you know, that hurts. And, but I agree. I mean, I, my thesis has always been that if this deal goes through, I think Amazon takes out someone, I think, you know, someone else comes in, possibly like an NBC Universal. JK, I know you have views on them, but you know, I think that, I mean, I know they had talks potentially, rumors were at least they had talks with EA at one point recently. So, you know, I think that there would be some consolidation in broadly interactive media, not just video games, with these larger players. But I do think that the industry is better served not just being rolled up into mega caps.
Got it. And maybe before we jump into specific names, we could have a quick discussion on AI too. Like, you know, everyone's talking about AI, NVIDIA in particular, just exploding. I know, Matt, you've been looking at NVIDIA quite a lot. And the word on the street is that there may be some stuff more gaming, AI, cross gaming related coming up. But what are your current thoughts, Matt?
So I'll talk about NVIDIA and then I'll talk about AI and gaming. And I'll just basically quote Strauss Zelnick because he said it best 2 quarters ago on the earnings call. But basically what NVIDIA came out and said is that they did about $4.2 billion of data center revenue in the most recent quarter ending April. And for the July quarter, they basically expect that to double. So they basically are expecting sequential growth of 80%. And they expect to basically be at a run rate of, well, they didn't put numbers on it, but the extrapolation is they'll be close to a $10 billion quarterly run rate by the fourth quarter. So by the January ending quarter. So this is like exponential growth in data center GPU demand. And this is entirely fueled by generative AI demand, what we're seeing from training large language models and then implementing them with inference. But it's also about supply. I think we're at a time where they're fortunate that the PC market and the smartphone market are just stinkers and TSMC has excess capacity right now. Because if this was 2021, TSMC is running at 100% utilization. Those sales aren't coming, that demand, those orders aren't getting filled for 3 quarters. So, you know, you're not looking at this hockey stick growth. You're looking at just the backlog being built really large. But we saw this with other companies. We saw triple ordering at that time because people were just putting in orders for shit and hope. We said we wouldn't curse, but there we go. People were putting in orders for stuff and then, you know, just waiting to see what came through. And then they would cancel the ones that didn't come through. So, you know, we're in an environment where they're fortunate that the supply chain isn't so backed up where they can fill those orders. Now, I think what's interesting about seeing this from NVIDIA or even Marvell today, where we're recording this day after NVIDIA earnings, but Marvell just printed, they're looking for basically a doubling of AI revenue this year and a doubling of AI revenue next year. So going from $200 million to $400 million to $800 million on a revenue base of $2 billion. So also very large numbers relative to the size of the company. I think what this is telling us is that generative AI is real and there's real fundamentals behind it. And I am guilty. I've been a big proponent of themes like the metaverse, which are long-term investment plays, decade out. We're looking at this transformation, but it gets hyped up and the stocks prices and everyone jumps in it. And there's really no fundamentals to back it up right now. There's real fundamentals backing up generative AI right now. We're seeing it in the chip space first because we have to build the infrastructure to power this, but we're even going to start seeing it in pretty much every sector of the economy. Jamie Dimon just said JP Morgan is going to build their own chatbot to replace customer service reps. And for gaming, I'll quote Strauss Zelnick. This is like the implementation of the calculator, right? The calculator was just a tool to make people more efficient. It didn't do your job for you. It enabled you to do more with what you have. And that's exactly what we're going to see now. And I use ChatGPT to help me write emails or help me write blog posts. Or, you know, we were coming up with a name for this podcast. And I just like, give me 10 examples or whatever, make me a list. So it's great at prototyping and just coming up with things that would take you as a human being longer to do. It's not smart. It's not trained to be smart. It doesn't think like we do. But it's a tool that can help you gain efficiencies in your workflow. And so there's all this concern that ChatGPT and generative AI are going to come and take your jobs. I don't necessarily believe that's true, but what I do fundamentally believe is that if you don't learn how to use generative AI tools and technologies, someone else who does will take your job.
Right.
Yeah, I think just touching on that NVIDIA print, that was just more violence than guidance. And I'm sure there's going to be some concerns on like choppiness or pull in, but if you're of the belief that VC investment into AI is going to balloon from here, much of the OPEX for these companies is going to be tech and tools, not headcount. And those checks are going to go straight to NVIDIA, and they're going to go straight to compute and storage companies. And this is going to be really good for even like just AWS and Azure workloads. So we're seeing that trickle through the market already. NVIDIA is really the tip of the spear. And there's been some appreciation already paid to companies that are able to offer like DTC apps, leveraging AI and monetizing. But I think broadly speaking, the market is going to need to play catch up to the broader semi supply chain, including semicap and memory and components. And I guess just from the pure game dev perspective, the job market has changed quite a bit year over year, with the power shifting back to the corporate side versus most of the talent side through the pandemic. And we're continuing to see a volley of layoffs across the games industry and broader tech. And of course, this impacts like our friends and our colleagues and their families. And from that perspective, I can certainly see why the proliferation of AI tools and tech can be like super discomforting. But at the same time, I've also seen a few instances in the startup arena where really talented teams that aren't nearly as well capitalized as a large publisher are able to leverage tools for coding help and art and narrative work. It's just straight up saving them time. And there wasn't an opportunity for a full-time employee there in anyway. And it's also increasing the skill sets of those folks. So I do think AI is going to spur, a new wave of innovation in games making and also cut back on some of the grind and crunch that I think especially JK is familiar with these days.
Very familiar.
There's also like this finance and corporate perspective that I think has the tendency to get overblown, where the overlords are all of a sudden able to make like a AAA FPS game in a few months with a fraction of the staff and suck up all the economics. But like at a high level, game making is not an easy business. And I don't think that gives enough credit to the teams that are able to make successful, differentiated games and experiences. And I do think that the potential to make games quickly and cheaply will exist and will continue to exist. But we've already seen that play out in the mobile gaming development sphere overseas, right? There's been a proliferation of derivative games. And that isn't like a risk that the industry hasn't weathered before. So, yeah, I'm very much of the belief that, we need to take this kind of day by day. But at a high level, I think it's pretty exciting.
Yeah, and since I'm more on the pixel side, and you guys are the kind of like the finance profit guys, but maybe I could provide a little bit more nuance in terms of some of the themes that I totally agree with you on, Brian, which is that I do think we are going to start, we're going to see, I think, impact to game development teams, but it's not all going to be at the same place at the same time. And so I do think like shorter term, we're probably going to see impact to like art teams first, let's call it within the next 2 to 5 years. And it's kind of like, you know, I mean, there was a structural shift in UA and kind of a performance marketing over the past 5 years, and that gutted a lot of teams by half. And there was like, for some teams, just a shift to outsourcing. And I think similarly, we'll see that kind of phenomenon hit art teams, especially like concept and eventually like production art fairly soon. And it's just amazing how fast the technology is moving, so that even 2 to 5 years might be conservative. But I don't know, sometimes I feel like even when the capability is there, sometimes adoption might be slow. So we'll see exactly how fast that diffuses. But I think also art related, the next thing that's going to hit, I think, is animations, right? And so I you know, there are animations can take a lot of time and resource. And I know, you know, you guys are fans of Call of Duty, but in a game like Call of Duty, where you might have like 6,000 animations just for locomotions, and where suddenly, you know, maybe you can get that done by, you know, one or a few people who trains a model, characterize animations, presses go, and you've got a bunch of stuff that normally would have taken a big team, lots of time, lots of money. And then I think the other thing that where there's been a lot of talk is like, and I haven't seen it personally, but there's been a lot of talk by various people saying that AI is going to be able to take a regular, or, you know, maybe even bad or mediocre programmer into a 10x programmer. And, you know, that's probably more from what I've seen. I haven't seen it yet, but if that's more medium, long-term, call it like 5 to 10 years, then I do think that what the impact of that will do is accelerate structural advantage for geo-favorable regions like China or India, where you've got, you know, generally lower capability or expertise, but then with the help of AI, they're all of a sudden being able to compete with like your, you know, 400 to 600K staff software engineer in California. You know what I'm saying?
Or even possibly like, I mean, you're talking about India and China today, which are already markets, but now you even bring in Southeast Asia, Latin America, potentially right. Sub-Saharan Africa, like places where game dev doesn't really even exist to a large degree yet. So, you know, it does open that up. I think that that scenario is fairly optimistic. Look, I think that there's a lot of things that game devs always want to do, and you know, ideas get shut down because it's not cost, you know, it just doesn't work out with the cost structure. Well, with generative AI, if you get that 25% efficiency gain that Goldman's calling out for knowledge workers globally within a decade, now those things that were previously cost prohibitive are now within the budget. And so you're able to do more with what you have. It goes back to our efficiency conversation. And I think that's why corporate executives are so, you know, bold up on generative AI. It's because we just talked a lot about efficiency and doing more with what we have. Now we have a tool that lets us do that. So let's just go right. All in on this and see what we get out of it.
Yeah, there's actually a concept that I've been talking about ever since like 2010, which I think AI finally enables to a much stronger degree, which is something that I call kind of large vector to small vector development. And what I mean by that is like by vector, I mean like the amount of resource, time, energy, effort it takes to build something, right? And I think what we've seen is that you've got platforms like Roblox and like UEFN and things like that, which takes care of a lot of things like the back. You don't have to be an expert in back end and DevOps and all these different kinds of capabilities and services. And so by just learning Lua, like the moat, the barrier to being able to take something from idea, from concept into a entertainment experience is dramatically shortened. So long vector to small vector. And I think with AI, I think we're going to increasingly see that where, you know, maybe you're not a programmer. Maybe you're just like an artsy fartsy type of, you know, liberal arts type of person, but you've got an incredible idea. But because of AI, you're able to kind of then be able to deliver that entertainment experience where you couldn't have done that before.
When I was doing the Into the Metaverse podcast, you know, mm-hmm. I talked to Roblox people, NVIDIA, Unity, the conversation always came down to one of the key points was always, how do we get creative tools to as many people as possible in the most no code environment as possible? And this was 2020, 2021. What we didn't know that we were talking about at the time was exactly this, right? Generative AI is the technology that enables text to world creation. This is the technology that unlocks the creative economy because now you don't need to know Lua. You don't have to know, I forget what the coding language is on Epic, right? You don't have to know these coding languages. Yeah. You just got to say, put a motorcycle in the world, make it red. And if you have an idea of what you want, now you can build it. And right. it's going to take time to get the kinks out, but that is super exciting when you're starting to think about, you know, the whole UGC economy.
Yeah. And I do think like the other thing, the one other concept or the implication, I think from that, like even if you're able to take a large vector development and decrease it by, let's say you make that cost 10X, I think you 100X the opportunity, right? So like, you know, it's not like a symmetrical sort of, you know, reduction in cost to expansion and opportunity. Well, guys, let's talk about something that's been, I'm seeing a lot of people talk about, but we could talk about Embracer and maybe some of these other public names where, you know, it's, you know, I think you guys actually like listen in on some of these earnings calls. Like I'll read transcripts and I'll review stuff, but you guys are actually really dialed in. And so maybe we can dive into that and starting with Embracer, but, you know, feel free to talk about any of the names that you think are interesting.
I know we were going to start off by saying something positive, at least by every company we're into. So I just will start there. I heard Dead Island 2 was okay. So I haven't played it yet, but maybe I will at some point in time.
They did beat estimates for the fiscal year ending March. So there's the positive spin. Now we can explain why the stock was down 45%.
Right. I think I have one other positive thing to say, and that this was probably my favorite quote of any earnings call I've ever seen. Up until late last night, we had amazing cash flow. And so now I'll break into my main point, which is that you don't guide on verbal commitments or even non-binding term sheets, okay? One of the main comforts around definitive docs is you have penalties and cures in place should something fall through for whatever reason. And, you know, this is just kind of vapor now. So for the folks that aren't aware of what happened, like they had a $2 billion verbal commitment for a 6-year kind of development cycle that just evaporated mysteriously the night before their conference call. You know, and I guess I've always been of the belief that it takes a special tool set to run a video games company in a public setting. We've alluded to that so much already. It's super clear now that it's just not present at Embracer. And there's this nuance or this kind of notion in finance of like the penalty box. And this certainly takes the cake from CDPR on the worst ever conference call. And this is an infinite penalty box.
The thing about this and you know, this management team may never have the trust of the public markets ever again. Like this might be the end of Lars's ability to have the trust of the stock market. We'll find out. I mean, if they can execute and turn the ship around, you know, they'll start to build it back. They're doing some stuff with Amazon and some stuff with Lord of the Rings stuff. So, you know, who knows? Maybe some stuff works, the business gets back on track. And, you know, they are still growing EBITDA next year. It's just not growing by as much as they thought it was because they took out this, you know, multi-billion SEC, couple hundred million dollars of EBITDA from this deal that was supposed to happen. So, you know, I think once the dust settles, they just need to execute to win back the market's trust. But if things don't turn around, like you could be talking about this being the end of his ability to run the company.
And just by the way, do you guys have any speculation on what that $2 billion or who that $2 billion, like, you know, there's not a lot of companies that can swing that around. Is that savvy or is that...
Are we going there, Matt?
I mean, I'll go there. Like, it's speculation. It's completely unfounded. So start the rumor mill. Like, you know, part of me thinks it could have been like, I'll say it could have been and why it would make sense. It could have been Sony. Sony's looking for external mobile development partners. They said that in their management briefing, which was the same day as Embracer's earnings. And if you go to the slide deck that Jim Ryan used, the only slide that's not like a fancy schmancy graphic is the slide where they say they're looking for development partners. Because it looks like that one was, you know, put together at the last minute, which you could then interpret as saying, well, maybe they had a deal and that fell apart. But Sony is a smooth operator. They don't operate like that. So, you know, it you know, probably not, but, you know, start the rumor mill. You could always throw out savvy because they'll be involved in everything. You know, it's notable that they put $1 billion into Embracer last year. Now they're down 80% on it. So, you know, who knows exactly if that was the deal. If they backed out because they had Scopely now, if they were in talks with Scopely before and now Savvy told them this, like there's so many possibilities that can go on. And without any definitive, you know, insight from anyone involved in discussions, we may never know. But, you know, if the news came out tomorrow and it said it was one of those, like, be okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
I don't have anything to add to that. Just noting again that it's just extraordinarily unusual to have a verbal commitment hanging out that long and then entering it into a company's guidance. And, you know, that's always going to catch up to you. And clearly it did today. And I don't need to kick people when they're down or whatever. I'm sure they're doing enough of that themselves. But it's just a cautionary tale that, you know, you don't even need to tell any other public company this because they simply wouldn't do it. Yeah, that's Embracer.
Okay.
Dead Island 2. I heard it's okay. You guys should go out and play it.
Brian, you want to drive the discussion around different names that you think are interesting to talk about?
I think, you know, I might as well just chat about Ubisoft real quick. I think, like, you know, I guess, you know, I'll just start off by saying that I've been playing Assassin's Creed games over the past few weeks just because it's on Microsoft Game Pass and it was free to download and everything like that. They have gotten incrementally better than when I stopped playing them 2 or 3 years ago. And I think it's a nice franchise to have in the mix. And they're clearly putting efforts towards developing that in the future. The most interesting thing for me for Ubisoft is kind of the pipeline. So just I got a line by line here and you guys can tell me if I'm crazy. Assassin's Creed Mirage, I think that should be well done, kind of back to the basics. It's an annual franchise for them. They could probably print what they need to on titles. Avatar Frontiers is kind of worth keeping an eye on. That's done by Massive Entertainment on the Snowdrop engine. That's the same studio as Division titles and Far Cry 3. Generally speaking, Ubisoft is pretty good at like these gorgeous open world maps. And I think the organic flow, movie timing and success will be really important to keep an eye on there. R6 Mobile, I'm a huge pass on. I think, you know, it's really late to get to the market now on a high def mobile FPS. Skull and Bones is kind of a nit for me. Half a decade in development. But the ironic part here is like Ubisoft is really good at these boat battle things, but it's just really like a feature in games. And they did it really well in Assassin's Creed, whatever else. But it's just like, I think Sea of Thieves ate their lunch there. And I've seen a couple startups developing games that are kind of similar that I think I'm a lot more positive on, with more persistent worlds and collection mechanics and team-based play. Then I'll kind of cap it off with Division Resurgence. I always play these games because they're co-op and they've showed promise in the past. But like my hang-up on commercial viability is that they kind of devolve into these bullet sponge messes, and they could probably use a guy like JK on it, really super hardcore metas. Division, for what it's worth, was ahead of its time. We were even chatting the other day about how they kind of set the foundations for extraction shooters. But, you know, Ubisoft's going to be a story about execution. Fundies are a mess. And I guess that being said, in terms of just what I'm looking at for earnings right now, I'm not super overblown curious about fundamentals, which sounds ridiculous. But given where we are with the economy, like flattish game trends and selectively lower gamer engagement, I've been paying way more attention to narrative shifts and catalyst paths versus just numbers and fundamentals. So Matt, over to you on Ubi.
With Ubisoft, you can pronounce whatever you want. The problem has always been execution, and they don't have scale within any franchise except for Assassin's Creed. I don't think there's any other franchise in their portfolio. Now, maybe Avatar, and you didn't mention Star Wars, is also being done by Massive. Maybe those are the ones that get them over the hump, but whatever threshold you think is big enough to justify the return on investment, call it 10 million units, they only really have one franchise that you can bank on, Assassin's Creed, where every game is going to sell at least 10 million units, right? And so I think the bigger problem, and JK, you pulled these numbers and you ran them and you wrote about it. It's like, you look at their revenue per employee, it's like less than half pretty much everyone else, including even like Embracer at this point. Like, and so it's just, they don't get full advantage of the resources they have. They don't have franchises at scale. And I don't know what fixes that, because they don't seem to care. They just think that they can keep whacking away and eventually Division will be a 10 million plus unit franchise. They think that Rainbow Six will be this massive franchise, and it kind of is, but on multiple platforms and really get that hockey stick on mobile, right? Their view is that they just keep doing what they're doing and it will work. And, you know, that's literally the definition of Einsteinian insanity. You know, I think that they need to, and I don't know when it happens, because they've gone through this so many times, but they, you know, Skull and Bones is a great example. Any other company would have killed that three times over at this point. And it's gone. Basically, they've restarted, what, twice? The development cycle on that game has been thrown out and started twice over. So it's just like, some of the decisions you just have to question, and you just have to think, would other companies make these decisions? I think that Assassin's Creed, they have down to a formula. They know what they're doing. I think it's 2 out of every 3 years, because they have two teams building it, working on a 3-year dev cycle. and they plan to increase their headcount in Assassin's Creed. That's great. Make Assassin's Creed a 20 million unit game instead of a 10 million unit game. Make that your tentpole franchise. But you have to look at things like, I'm even a fan of Mario Rabbids. It was my favorite Switch game. How much money are you spending on that? South Park, right? They made a South Park game. Like, cool, fun. I'm a South Park geek. But the ROI on that, the justification financially, I just don't think is there. Moving over to Take-Two, the house that Strauss built, right? So if we look at what's happening there, I mean, the stock went up a lot after earnings, but it wasn't necessarily the fundamentals. You know, Brian, you want to dive in and then we can kind of jibber-jab about what they said?
Yeah, I mean, the current quarter is a little soft versus guidance expectations, but, you know, it didn't matter. This is always the point in time that the hedge fund consortium waits for, and that's whenever we start hearing a little bit more about what GTA 6 looks like from a forward guidance perspective. Zynga, of course, kind of in line as to their expects and softness and RCS from PC and console. I think like the part that is going to be a little bit more interesting this cycle, this time around, and by cycle, I mean GTA cycle, which essentially is Take-Two, is that, you know, this time it has a giant mobile business inside of it. And if you asked any investor over the past 8 or 9 months, like what their favorite stock name was before the Zynga transaction, it was always Take-Two, right? You're going to own this in the GTA 6 cycle. But now it's just like, it's not good or bad or whatever. Zynga has its merits and maybe it works from here or not, but it's just not as clean of a story anymore. And it's, for what it's worth, like it's hard pressed to say that GTA 6 won't break all sorts of sales records for units and set up another 5+ year stretch of just printing silly money. And I do firmly believe that. And I do want to be an owner of that over that course of time. And the one thing I'd also mention is just, it's really hard to dive in on pipeline on Take-Two these days. There's nothing of note really outside of that dream of GTA 6, which could slip, by the way, wouldn't be the first time. But there's a lot of launches pinned on fiscal 23 through 25, 87, in fact, in their presentation, but less than 10% are named. And like any other publisher, all those are subject to hit rate.
I will say, just because we talked about Embracer, like relative to Embracer, this is the way to give long-term forward guidance. When you have a known commodity in Grand Theft Auto and you have high visibility, they would not be coming out unless they were highly confident that basically Grand Theft Auto is a holiday 2024 game, right? I mean, it's basically plugged in for that unless something drastic happens in the development process at this point. And so they're coming out and basically saying that they expected them. And that's how they're putting the 8 billion or whatever number of bookings in the market, because they are extremely confident that that is coming. It's not a handshake agreement for 2 billion of revenue. And so it's just a nice contrast to what we talked about with Embracer. But Brian's absolutely right. Like, hedge funds used to love this stock because you could ride the GTA cycle, the Red Dead 2 cycle. That was big too. Now you've got Zynga, which, you know, it's stable. It does its thing, but you don't get that cyclicality. It's not as tradable. It's more steady eddy beta growth, right? And so it makes it less attractive to hedge fund investors who want volatility, who want to ride those cycles.
But maybe I could push back a little bit on the Zynga acquisition, and, you know, not to be too negative and whatever, but if we believe that, you know, a lot of, as we had discussed earlier in the podcast, that a lot of Zynga's growth came off of M&A, and, you know, they were clearly, I mean, that strategy had basically played itself out, and, you know, they were kind of flailing around for growth, like, right? They bought an MMP and they were trying to do stuff with Rollic and with IDFV. And I mean, nothing that they were trying was landing. And so to the point you made, Matthew, they got bailed out. A lot of the mobile pipeline, whether it's Star Wars Hunters or other games, you know, it sounds like it's not going great. I mean, you know, I can see Zynga being relatively steady-ish to like maybe lower, slower growth moving in the future, but I don't know.
It has EBITDA. It prints cash flow. Like, that's, at least it does that, because there's been acquisitions that have been done before where they're dilutive to EBITDA, dilutive to cash flow, and you never get your money back. At least from that perspective, you can at least look at it and say, even if the revenue synergies, the IP sharing, all the stuff they talked about doesn't work, which it probably won't, they'll at least get their money back because Zynga has EBITDA and cash flow, right? I mean, people forget that there was several years after Activision bought King, and King is different because they had one big game, but a lot of EBITDA, but that business did not grow for several years. It basically didn't grow from they bought it until 2020, you know, on EBITDA basis. So, but it still printed money. It just didn't live up to the expectations. But at least you're getting something in return. You're getting cash flow in return. And Zynga does give that to Take-Two.
I would say if I could agree with JK on one point there, and we brought this up earlier, the really complex Fatui games with really deep metagames are not in a great place in this market to attract new gamers. For one reason, because they've already been through, you know, the UA motion for 5 or 6 years or whatever. And if you're going to find those players over that course of time, you've already found them. And I would challenge like investors out there that maybe haven't played some of those games, give them a try. See if you can put up with the half hour it takes to figure out the economy and things like that. So at a high level, I don't think this was always just a hedge fund hotel that people rode through cycles. It was like a duration play too, because if you could hold that name for 3 to 5 years, you knew Strauss was going to make you money on GTA or Rock or Red Dead or whatever else. The story's a little bit muddier now. I don't like it quite as much, but it's still, you know, near the top in pecking order, because it's just, like, frankly, not that much left in gaming.
Yeah, and maybe the one other comment I can make is that sometimes, like, the financial perspective is that you get these synergies, right? And I think, like, there was some thinking around that when Activision acquired King, that maybe there'd be synergies between mobile and Blizzard and things of that nature. But, you know, word on the street is that it may not even be friendly. It may actually be the opposite of friendly in terms of, you know, some of these teams trying to work together and being forced into the same rooms. And if I understand the word on the street on Take-Two, it may be, you know, again, it may be not adversarial, but I do think like the development of synergies between mobile and HD and, you know, leveraging IPs in different ways across different platforms. You know, I think that that may not happen to the extent that some finance guys are believing that will occur.
It turns out that Match 3 developers don't know how to make mobile Call of Duty. I mean, who would have thunk, right?
My finance brain can't handle this. I think the other part that's worth noting too is that if you're looking at studios like a Small Giant or a Peak to develop a new hit game, the economic incentive for creatives inside of a company like that that's been acquired a long time ago just doesn't exist. They're not going to do it there. They're going to do it somewhere else, or they're going to do it on their own. So just something to keep in mind. Right. The games as they are, they'll be stable-ish. They'll print money. It'll make overall fundies look good. And more importantly, I think it kind of smooths the flows that you'd see from like the revenue for Take-Two over the course of time. Those valleys were pretty unattractive, but you always knew something was coming to lift it up.
Who's next?
Unity.
Where's Dave Chappelle?
Oh. Yeah.
It's interesting because I know people are going to talk about NVIDIA and how much they talked about AI, but JR definitely gives Jensen a run for his money.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think this is just one of those names that kind of launched out in that 2021 time frame that, you know, just kind of got ahead of itself a little bit and has settled more to like a rational level. It's still kind of an expensive stock. I think the things that are most acute to me is doubling down on $1 billion of EBITDA by the end of 2024 run rate. So that suggests something like $250 million in EBITDA in Q4. And let's keep in mind, this company is still not yet profitable. The Create business also decelled down quarter over quarter. And there's some fluctuation and nuance there with increased pricing. We all know they pass through pricing increases to most of their customers. Some of those haven't rolled through yet. So you're counting on that reinvigorating growth in the second half alongside growth in Grow, which is the business they bought that was formerly named Iron Source. So certainly some room for execution misses. There's also this impact of layoffs and morale that is not unique to Unity. So that's something I can really pin them on. But I do want to like chat a little bit about AI and Unity. And I think that, you know, Unity is seen as a super easy tool for game devs, but game dev specialists. And the thought here is that if you can broaden that user base through ease of use and accessibility through chat tools, perhaps that translates into more customers down the line. But there's also the counterpoint to that. And if games can be made by less people, that would translate into less licenses and seats. And in that scenario, it's really important for Unity to capture more value in the chain, increase pricing, or shift like their new AI or other products to more ratable or volume driven pricing. And I think that's probably the thing we got to keep an eye on.
Yeah, I mean, aside from being bulled up on AI, JR was bulled up on consumption pricing. I think it's kind of a rock and a hard place for them, right? Because existentially, to grow and be this company they want to be, they need to change their business model to consumption based, because they'll never not just gaming, if you do believe in the metaverse and real-time 3D everywhere, they're never going to capture a large percentage of that end market TAM as a subscription software vendor. They need the model that Epic has, which is revenue sharing, profit sharing, because then you're capturing a percentage of the end market. And so it's kind of like they're damned if they do, damned if they don't. If they change their pricing to consumption-based, a lot of the devs who like Unity because of the predictable cost are going to find an alternative. Potentially, they're going to be upset. They're not going to want to be on Unity anymore. Or they go to Epic because now Unreal is a better technology. It's more advanced and it's now cost comparable because I'm not saving money anymore. So, you know, there's a lot of conversations that happen there. Or you stick with your pricing and you never live up to the expectations that were baked in your IPO.
Yeah, I think one danger is just what I view as kind of missed execution. So especially on the engine side, I'm not going to speak too much on like the ad network side or other parts of Unity's business, but as a game studio that uses Unity, it's been very disappointing to see so many other friends in the industry kind of switching out of Unity, going to Unreal. And I mean, the value prop has always, currently is that, you know, if you're building for mobile, if you don't have a highly skilled technical team that can code in C++ and things like that, that, you know, Unity makes more sense for you. But, you know, when I see some of the, the lack of stronger execution against initiatives like DOTS and you know, supporting more data-oriented programming capability. When I see that, you know, Unreal is just more fully featured and like the feel of games that you can make in Unreal is just better. And I mean, it's like, in theory, you can make this the same graphical fidelity in Unity or Unreal, but the lift to get there in Unity is just harder. And so, I don't know. I do also think that, you know, we speak about the age of efficiency. I don't think Unity's there. So I would, you know, and again, this I'm speaking as a fan and as a customer and somebody who really, really, really wants Unity to succeed. But man, if they could only execute better, you know, I would be a much happier customer. So I hope that comes. And, but yeah, I think in the, I don't know. It does seem like change needs to come to Unity. I think whether bringing in more of a technical lead or something to help drive better execution in terms of the engine part of the business would be a lot better. It would help the business a lot more.
I mean, that's why they brought in Mark Witten to run Create, right? I mean, they brought him in a year ago. So I don't know if it's too early to say that it hasn't worked or not, but he did come in to bring in a more technical person in that role. There's a new head of the Grow business, which is the admon and plus Iron Source, right? And new CFO. So they, aside from JR, they have turned over the management suite. Okay. I think it's just kind of, are these the right people is always going to be the question, but you know, I think we'll find out. I don't think it'll take too long for us to find out.
I would say too, I think, you know, absent the pandemic boom and the markets acting like they were at that time, I struggle to think that Unity was ready for an IPO or perhaps maybe too subscale and might be a better fit inside of a larger company at some point that has more dedication to not only like gaming, but being committed to the tools and tech and improving the software over time versus being too over-focused on company fundamentals. You wouldn't know that the company is too small from the market cap when it came out. But like now you're starting to see that a little bit. It just doesn't have sufficient scale to do the kind of things that are necessary under the guise of the public markets.
Like an Adobe would have made sense.
Like an Adobe.
Like a large creative software company, maybe even like a Salesforce, right? You know, a company like that, that has strong execution record on their products, both organically and inorganically.
What's next? EA?
We can be positive for once.
Yeah. Yeah, look, banner year for FIFA, the last year officially of the FIFA brand. That includes mobile, where it carried the rest of the mobile portfolio to growth. Apex HD humming on engagement despite lots of competition and competitive shooters. Sims users up sharply. They also shifted to free to play, so probably smart for the franchise given how late it is in that cycle. Star Wars Jedi, choppy-ish launch on PC, but otherwise very well received this year. And I would say just EA has always been extraordinarily prudent with guidance around titles like this and a reasonable assumption they will beat expectations. pipeline, super sports focused. But again, they very much typically deliver against expectations. The mobile titles I wouldn't lean too far in on. And again, EA typically doesn't. So this is kind of super boring. But the biggest question for EA for me next year is whether or not the FIFA brand matters. And we won't really be able to get a beat on that until September or October launch. And Matt, I think they're guiding for like low single digits.
They're guiding like low single digit growth. So plug in like 3%, which is really actually super strong because this was a record year for FIFA. And remember the Winter World Cup basically extended the tail of the launch engagement, right? Because they launched FIFA in September and you normally start to trail off throughout the year. That's just the cadence of the game. But because of the December World Cup, they definitely got a much bigger boost in that quarter to FIFA, and that made it the most successful FIFA of all time, right? And so for them to come out and say they expect EA Sports FC next year to grow 3% on top of FIFA last year, not only is that them saying that the brand of FIFA doesn't matter, but we think that the World Cup boost, we can still lap that and still grow. I think that's those two things together are quite encouraging. And granted, the guidance was for FIFA overall. I don't believe it was console only. So FIFA Online in Asia is doing really well. That doesn't get talked about. That's the Nexon joint venture in Korea, Japan, and Tencent in China. But then also mobile, right? So when you kind of put the pieces together, like it may not be the cleanest story ever, but it's still very encouraging that they're looking at the franchise and saying, even without the FIFA brand, even with this comp, we still think we're going to beat our best year ever.
Do you guys think that someone else picks up the FIFA license and goes head to head?
It's just going to
matter.
Yeah,
it doesn't matter.
Even if they did, you know, it takes an extraordinary long time. I mean, Jake doesn't need me to tell him that. But to build a game that's that polished and has that long of history with fans and things like that, I think the more likely scenario is if it disappoints a bit, they find a way to come back together again, but maybe not in such a usury context.
The Champions League tried to do this several years ago to EA. They went to Konami and gave the Champions League to PES, and it did absolutely nothing. And then they came crawling back and did a deal with EA. Mm-hmm. Like, all right, you know, could Saudi Arabia sign a deal with FIFA and be like, yeah, we're going to spend all this money and make a game? Sure. It's going to take you 5 years and it's not going to be as good and you're never going to make your money back, but go for it. You'll eventually come crawling back to EA if you want your money.
So Scopely.
You got a hot take. Last up is AppLovin. So like this one for me was entirely a positioning trade. Shares are taking quite a beating, somewhat of a consensus short, like mobile is dead, UA is over, the model has changed, new paradigm and all this stuff. But you know, Matt can probably go through the funnies a little better than I can, but big beat on EBITDA, growth in the publishing software business, and all good again, back to a more rational market cap, given how profitable the company is from a total income statement perspective. And, you know, it's worth debating.
Yeah. We'll see how sustainable what they printed is, you know, beyond just the next quarter, but it at least to your point, it positioning people were short the stock going into this, you know, UA was dead, long live UA, right? That's kind of the mantra right now. It's entirely evident that, and JK, you did a good podcast about this recently, right? It's, you know, we got to stop blaming Apple. We got to stop blaming UA is dead because people are figuring it out. So go be creative and figure it out because it's clear that there's ways to do this now in the post IDFA world. We can't just sit here and blame Apple for the next 5 years because that's not going to work, right? So whatever they figured out and it was working. The stock jumped 24%. It's still down, what, 80% from the IPO or from the post IPO high. So like, you know, we're talking about, you know, it's still retraced a lot and people that bought it there are still way underwater, but at least what they're showing is that they are committed to cost cuts. They're committed to growing EBITDA. They're focused on their software business. They're no longer really investing in their own apps and their game business. So they're getting the valuation uplift of a real software player now. They're no longer this hybrid flywheel, Eric Seifert, what is it? Content Fortress. It's no longer a Content Fortress play. They are good at admon. They're good at tech. They have a technology advantage versus some other peers in the market. They are leaning into it.
I guess the thing that I think about on this one is, again, this was a 2021 IPO, if I'm not mistaken. And they had the benefits of the pandemic to a games business that they had done mostly through inorganic transactions. So looking forward to the next couple of years, are they satisfied with being a software business that helps other businesses grow? while de-emphasizing or selling off studio assets, or do they try to mature into something bigger or, you know, whatever else? They obviously try to tie up with Unity, which didn't happen. But that actually would have been a pretty interesting combo, right? Do they do something else
like that? That to me looked like it was more out of weakness than out of strength, right? Because they basically came in at the 11th hour. And if you read some of like the proxy statements, the SEC filings, you can see like some of the emails and phone calls. And it's actually quite telling that basically like once Unity announced Iron Source, and mind you, those deals, you know, Brian, you did this, right? Those deals don't happen overnight. Those deals are months in the works, right? And so when they announce it, and you know, CEO of AppLovin calls up JR and says, I want to call with you, and then says, I'm bidding for your company, that's out of a position of weakness. He's worried about his business at that point, right? And so, sure, there was synergies, financial engineering that could have worked in that deal. But, you know, I look at that and I'm just like, you get worried when a company starts doing crazy rash things like that. Because if they're worried, how can you be confident in the stock at that point?
If I had to surmise what happened there, they probably saw a giant gulf that was about to impact their business and did not see a path where they could weather that storm. And they are a relatively new public company and didn't want to disappoint people in some respects. So they had to make drastic moves. But instead, like to their credit, they took their lumps, they weathered through it. They didn't make up a $2 billion deal off of a verbal agreement. And now things are a little bit better.
Yeah, I think it's important to note that with respect to AppLovin, the fundamental thesis behind Adam Farooqi's sort of vision for the company failed, right? So he wanted to make AppLovin be the Netflix of apps. And there was a reason why they went and bought an MMP. And there was a reason why they bought all these game studios, which now that thesis didn't pan out, right? And so now I think he's got to try to figure out what he does. And I think to your point, Brian, you mentioned these, you know, game studio assets. Doesn't really make sense to be part of AppLovin anymore, in my opinion. I don't know where that the you know, now that thesis is kind of fallen through. I would expect that I don't know if they can get a good price for it, but I would expect them to try to, you know, divest themselves from all the game studio.
They've tried for the last few quarters. It's just been, there's no bites, there's no bids on that, anything like that right now.
Yeah.
Also, owning a games business too also sets you up with in a weird position to your customers, right? Because in some respects, you're competing with them with lower quality products that you acquired or derivative products.
Yeah, that's, and there's been a history of some, you know, of some, but, you know, millions.
I was just going to say they did stop investing new incremental dollars in those businesses. Right. So like from an R&D growth perspective, from a cash flow perspective, like at least they're no longer incrementally a drag on the P&L of AppLovin. I think they would like to sell them if they got the right price. They just haven't, no one's hit the bid yet.
Right. All right. Well, if that's the last name, should we end with just like things for anything that people should be watching out for? Any like predictions or, you know, hot takes or anything like that from you guys?
Yeah, we didn't do enough hot takes. I think we should maybe just chat quickly about what we think about some of these public companies. Like the the counterpoint or the counterpoint to like lower share prices is the potential for acquisitions. And I think that's probably what we can wrap up on. I would say that my targets in order of some sort of likelihood or whatever, or that are at least interesting potentially now would be Ubisoft or CD Projekt. Take-Two and Unity are my outliers because they're kind of chunky, but that's kind of what I'm focused on.
iGaming is getting large in the US and it's already kind of large in Europe. iGaming is legal, real money games. So like social casino, but with real money. Now I think I forget the number. I think it's legal in 27 states in the US with visibility to over 30. So plus or minus 50% of the population. Sports betting is 35 states now with visibility to about 2/3 of the population going forward. So in Round Hill, we have the Roundhill Sports Betting and iGaming ETF. There's your plug. But, that's interesting because you just saw Aristocrat come out and buy NeoGames, which specializes in basically what looks like hyper casually instant gamesy real money iGaming, like, you know, lottery type stuff. So it's quite interesting how a lot of these companies in the iGaming space are replicating a lot of what was done in mobile across the spectrum of quality, from hyper casual instant games all the way up to, you know, real social casino, real whale hunting. So, you know, that's interesting, because if that really does take off, that's competing directly with social casino for money. Because I know that, you know, people will say no, blah, 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 but at the end of the day, why would I play a fake casino when I can possibly make real money, right? Like, it, at some point that behavior might shift, and that's a risk for social casino, which is a large part of the mobile game market.
Yeah. I mean, I think as we've seen retrenchment in the industry, I do think that, like, the remaining, call it big swinging dongle in the room is the Saudis, right? And so I feel like, to your point on Ubi, I do think there needs to be some changes. I don't know if the Saudis are the ones to effect that change, but it does feel like if the G brothers are allowed to be left in control, maybe something happens there.
They need Elon to just come in and clean house like he did at Twitter.
I heard of an idea recently, which was maybe like the Saudis could like potentially put Scopely together with EA if they allow Andrew Wilson to stay in control and try to do something along those lines. And then just word on the street, look out for WB Gaming. Something might happen.
Because I think that
that's not surprising either. Because, I mean, when AT&T was trying to get rid of HBO and Warner Brothers, that was on the block at that point. That business is, you know, now it's Warner Brothers Discovery. It's perpetually over leveraged and underperforming on their metrics. So we'll always look to carve off anything that has value.
Just talking my book on big transactions over small ones, strategic over financial engineering. Agree.
All right, guys. Well, this was a little bit of a longer pod, but thanks so much, Brian, Matthew. Let's keep rolling. Let's do this again. And
just to clarify, it's profits, profits. We're not seers into the future. We're probably going to be wrong in most of the things we say.
I get spelled different, right? I don't know.
Awesome. All right, guys. And for our audience, we'll catch you next time. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Jay.